The pandemic has revived the issue of a universal basic income, a chunk of money given to every citizen at regular intervals, no strings attached, a guaranteed income floor. This, it is argued, would relieve the insecurity and anxiety around 21st century jobs, help the working poor, alleviate poverty and address inequality. Trials have been done in Finland, for example. There's one running in Wales. And now a UBI of £1,600 a month for 2 years is proposed in England. Stuart Lansley is an honorary fellow at the School of Policy Studies at the University of Bristol. His most recent book is The Richer, the Poorer, a 200-year history of how Britain enriched the few and failed the poor, And he's an expert in and an advocate for a universal basic income. I said, wow, £1,600 a month for 2 years, which is the UBI proposed in England, is not to be sneezed at, is it?
It's on the sort of generous end of what of the various possible ranges of a starting level for UBI. My own position on this, and I've done a number of simulations of models, is that in terms of getting it off the ground, we probably need to start at a much more modest level. I think the purpose of this trial is really to, it's not actually going to test a real system, the kind of system you can actually implement at one go. The whole aim is to try and see the impact of what a full-blooded scheme would look like, and to try and raise the profile, to try and raise consciousness, to try and refuel, if you like, the or continue to fuel the debate that's already started.
Well, the problem is the problem that all trials incur, isn't it? That there will be costs and there will be some people who will lose, taxpayers, for example, in the higher levels. And the trials of any universal basic income don't look at that. They only look at those who gain.
Yes. Trials have a limited role to play. It's extremely difficult to replicate in a trial how a full scheme would work. But that doesn't mean to say that they're not valuable. I mean, I think we've learned a lot from previous trials. And there have been trials on various countries that have happened over the last few decades. There's the recent Finnish trial, which gave us, you know, quite a lot of evidence about how a scheme might work. But I think the principal role of trials really is to really ignite the excitement around the idea of such a transformative idea. And I think the purpose of this trial, and don't forget there's already a trial taking place in Britain and Wales that started, that's been going for nearly a year. So this is a small scale, very localised trial, which will be community-based. So the community will be heavily involved in it, will have a steering committee run by local people and so on. So it's very much a ground-level local community test of a much bigger idea.
There are various views about a UBI, of course, as you've discussed in a paper that you co-authored for Compass, which is a think tank in the UK. And 5 years ago, you argued for a model which paid something like £80 a week, varying according to age and circumstance and dependence, in addition to the existing benefit system, which kind of surprised me because I thought that one of the attractions of a UBI was its simplicity. You get rid of that plethora of, you know, benefits and tax and subsidies and allowances that does everybody's heads in, and just give them a chunk of cash. You don't want to see that.
think it would be, I think the lesson that we've learned from different models of social security in Britain is that if you go for sort of big bang changes, if you try and sweep away the whole of the existing system and replace it with another system, you generate all sorts of problems. That's happened with the introduction of universal credit a decade ago. So I believe that we should move in small steps. We shouldn't do anything that's too dramatic in one go. So I think the best way to go is to start with a relatively small scheme, which would be affordable. It would require some sort of modest tweaks to the tax system to pay for it, but would also have a pretty powerful effect. The latest study that we've done shows that even the modest starting levels, which I've been proposing, which is £40 for a child and £60 for an adult, that's the equivalent of around £10,000 a year for a family of four. Not enough to live on, but if it's guaranteed, you know it's coming, it can be transformative. We found that that would cut poverty in Britain by over a half.
The dilemma is, of course, it has to be enough to make a difference, but not too expensive. And if it's not targeted, it's going to either be much more expensive or some people are going to get less support. Would that not be right?
No, very. No, nobody would lose out under
Nobody.
our proposal. Nobody would lose out, and it's highly progressive. So most of the gains would go to the poorest third in Britain, and the people who would pay for it would be people at the very top.
Well, there's the one. There's the ones. I mean, I know your heart doesn't bleed for them, but they would lose out then.
Yes,
Right.
quite. They would lose out, but we're talking about quite small amounts. So the scheme would be quite redistributive. It would have two elements. First of all, this guaranteed payment, which yes, it's an income floor. The whole idea is to create what I've called as an income plimsoll line, below which nobody would fall. And even if that starts at a low level, it could still have very profound effects. So that they're essentially two things going on. First of all, there's this income floor, and secondly, there would be adjustments to the tax system to pay for it, which would make the tax system more redistributive than it is at the moment.
I was surprised that you were so kind of small scale to begin with, because you quote Beveridge, who said in 1942, I only know this because you told me, right, that creating a low poverty, low inequality society requires much more than patching. And it seems to me that if you're not giving people enough to live on, and you're still keeping the whole welfare system, that sounds a bit patchy.
It's really not patchy. I mean, you can tell it's not patchy by the fact that there is actually quite a major and in some ways, quite ferocious debate in the UK
You can tell it's
about
not
the
patchy because some
merits.
people hate it.
Well, it's not patchy because it would have a dramatic effect, and you would gradually. I think the nearest parallel I can think of is the national minimum wage. When we introduced the national minimum wage, which was a highly controversial idea, and most businesses hated it, and even some trade unions weren't very enthusiastic. When we introduced that in 2000, it started at a very modest level. It's gradually been increased over time as a share of average earnings. It started small because they didn't want the too many big shocks on employment levels, and by starting small, it meant that it was pretty effective. And now virtually everybody in Britain believes in the national minimum wage. I mean, it's the Conservative Party that's actually raised it a few times in relation to earnings over the last decade. So I think we should see a UBI a little bit like that. You probably, even a small scheme, even a modest starting scheme, is a pretty major reform of the social security and tax systems. And I think it does conform with the Beveridge demand for something pretty radical. So even the most, I mean, I've been accused of thinking small. And I think that's essentially what you're kind of saying now, thinking small. I don't see this as thinking small. I think this would be a very radical shift. And if we went in all drums blazing and with a very, very generous scheme, it would be fantastically expensive. It would shake things up quite dramatically. And I just think it would be far better to start with a modern scheme that we know we can make work, that I think people would warm to very, very quickly. And I think it would be a bit like the national minimum wage. Even the sceptics would eventually come round, and then we can move forward with that scheme.
Even at a modest scale, would this UBI not effectively be subsidising employers who would be relieved of even trying to pay a living wage? How would that work?
It would actually have the opposite effect. Because low-paid employees at the moment, and particularly ones that are insecure and don't have very good working conditions, their bargaining power would increase because they've got behind them this guaranteed income. They don't have to take the first job that comes along. They can turn down and wait and look around a bit more because they've got this cushion. So one of the effects of such a scheme is they would actually improve the bargaining power of the weaker members of the labour force. We believe that this would actually, far from cutting wages, it would, you know, particularly at the low level, it would gradually increase them because employers would have to offer a slightly better deal than they do at the moment in order to get people. So I think it would have the opposite effect than the one you're suggesting.
Let's talk about the universality, obviously, of the UBI. People who don't need it will get it. And you've accepted that the system as it is able to deliver large sums to some targeted groups. Targeting, surely, is more efficient.
There are two ways of looking at the Social Security system. Until the Second World War, you know, we had a 100% targeted system, a means-tested system, which was incredibly intrusive. It was hated by nearly everybody who received help. And what the Beveridge reforms did was to introduce the idea of universalism, that we should have a two-part system of Social Security. We should have a certain emphasis on universality, that everybody is entitled because of the nature of citizenship to a minimum living standard. And so there were a number of universal elements that were introduced. The National Health Service that goes to everybody, family allowances that went to everybody, a national insurance scheme that everybody could participate in. And that what's happened over the last, you know, 50 or 60 years is that the universal side of this support system has been eroded dramatically. And the means-tested system, the targeted system, has risen. And there are huge numbers of problems with this targeted system. It's almost back to the kind of pre-war type of system, which is highly punitive.
The deserving poor.
Yes, I mean, the thing about universal system, I mean, if we look at some of the elements of universalism, like child benefit, which is a payment that goes to all children, irrespective of the income of the parent, on the grounds that it's absolutely right that the state subsidise, gives help with the bringing up of children, because children are a huge resource, because they are very important to society. And you know, become a bit of a shock to the system if you didn't get support. Child benefit is something that no government would be able to take away because it's so popular. So universalism has a role to play. And what the UBI would do was try and take us back a bit to where we were after the Second World War with a boost to the universal element of the support system and less reliance on a highly complex and highly punitive system of means testing.
You've said that it was believed by many until 2008 that inequality is necessary for economic growth. Do people not believe that anymore?
I think there has been a remarkable transformation in our attitudes nationally and globally towards inequality. And the reason for that is that inequality has surged. The gap between the rich and the poor within nations has surged since we achieved peak equality. I mean, Britain and other countries achieved a peak level of equality in the 1970s.
Yeah, didn't know how lucky you didn't know how lucky you were.
We don't know how lucky. Absolutely, this was the era of egalitarianism. We then had this counter revolution against equality, which culminated in, you know, this great gap and in the 2008 crash. And what happened is that economists began to realise that very, very high levels of inequality, when you concentrate income and wealth dramatically at the top, also undermines economic resilience because it makes the bulk of the population dependent on debt in order to make a decent standard of living. So the IMF, for example, the International Monetary Fund, which had always been very, very pro-market, very, very pro some of the, you know, move towards inequality, suddenly changed its mind and said that inequality was one of the principal causes of the crash of 2008. So what's happened is that we've had this big debate, global debate about inequality. And it's widely accepted, even by economists on the right, that inequality has gone much too far. And we need to reduce it, not just questions of justice, not just to cut poverty levels and for fairness, because ultimately, very high levels of inequality weakens and makes economies much less resilient.
You're talking as if this is conventional wisdom, but austerity in Britain over the last few years has completely slashed public spending and slashed benefits. So did they not get the memo?
So you're absolutely right. I mean, there's nothing new about, you know, contradictions in policy making. So, you know, politicians, you know, engage in this kind of double speak, don't they? You know, they declare on the one hand that, they want to improve the lot of everybody, but they want to reduce these great gaps while following policies that actually make it worse. So that's not very surprising. And what's happened is that this talk, you know, at a very high level, I wouldn't say it is close to a conventional wisdom that inequality is too high. But unfortunately, that recognition hasn't been translated into a policy response. It hasn't, you know, to use Beveridge's term, if we're going to sort inequality, you know, patching, we don't even have patching, you know, and patching wouldn't be enough. We need some dramatic changes if we're going to tackle that. And to me, this is an imperative that the world, you know, we are on the edge, I think, of very difficult times. If we fail to just, it's not as big as an issue as climate change, but it is a big issue because it's undermining fairness. It's causing turbulence within and across the globe, and it is something that I think, you know, we are going to have to tackle if we're going to improve the lot of Britain and other countries and the globe in the next decade.
It is a bit of a patch, Stuart, isn't it? If you accept your argument that corporate extraction by a small elite has captured gains from economic activity, and shareholders and executives have pocketed massive amounts of money, and you're not going to solve that by bringing in a relatively modest form of universal basic income, are you?
UBI is not a silver bullet. It can't solve all the problems that we have, and we have to have a series of parallel policies if we're going to tackle inequality. What a UBI will do is raise the floor a little bit, so it will offer a much more solid level of protection. But we need to go very much further than that. I mean, for me, the most important issue to tackle inequality is the question of wealth. The level of private wealth in Britain and across the globe has increased dramatically in the last four decades. In Britain, wealth as a proportion of the size of the economy has increased from 3 times to 7 times. Very little of that increase in wealth as a result of wealth creation, something that's building and strengthening companies and building social infrastructure. Most of it has been caused by this process of extraction. What that does, essentially, it sucks out this process of enrichment that's now taking place in big companies, in which companies have effectively been turned into cash cows for executives and investors, is sucking resources out of economies. If you look at the increase in profits and an increase in rewards and dividends over the last, all of which have escalated very sharply, and you chart them against levels of private investment, these rewards have been escalating and the levels of private investment have been falling. So what's been happening essentially is that the lifeblood of the economy has been weakened in order to enrich this 1%. And that is not something that can continue if we're going to prevent this continuing economic turbulence that we've had since 2008.
But this sounds a bit Brechtian. I never know whether I'm using that properly. But, you know, you give them bread, it'll make them contented and passive. You bring in your version of a universal basic income and your corporate extractors will carry right on doing what they're doing because the poor are being looked after. I'm not sure how the momentum that you imagine is going to continue after such a UBI.
Well, as I say, I mean, if you look at post-war history, we don't do everything at one go, do we? I mean, what we did in 1945, and the interesting thing about 1945 is that nearly all the rich countries took a number of very dramatic steps. You know, we had this, you know, quite dramatic stage of social reform. Since then, what we've had is occasional changes. You know, we had child benefit was introduced. We've had the national minimum wage in Britain, and so on. So you get this sort of gradual approach. The UBI is just one of the reforms that I think that we will need. And it won't do the job on its own. It's a very powerful instrument. What we really need is that what happened after the war is that countries like Britain and many countries brought into place institutional changes that were pro-equality, that actually ensured that the economy and society worked in such a way that they didn't allow people to sink too low. I mean, those pro-equality forces were things like the National Health Service, things like stronger bargaining power, things like family allowances. So a lot of those have been stripped away. And what we need now is a sort of reform on the scale of 1945 that reintroduces these pro-equality instruments, which will not only strengthen social resilience and give people more choices, but will also strengthen economic resilience. And UBI is one of those policies, but it's not the only one. And for me, the other element that is particularly important is to take these dramatic wealth pools that we have. I mean, there's a huge wealth mountain. But in the UK, it's only taxed at a rate of about 2%, even though wealth is 7 times as large as income. And even modest, if we could harness some of that wealth, then we could use that for social reconstruction to rebuild societies that have been ravaged by 2008, by austerity, by COVID, and, you know, help to rebuild societies by putting this wealth, which is in many ways, has a malign effect on the economy, on economies and put it to use for the common good.
And is that what you mean by a citizens' wealth fund?
Yes, it is. I think that what happens is we're all born into huge array of institutional wealth. You know, when 80 or 90%, when each of us is born, we inherit this huge social and economic infrastructure that has been built by our four parents. And yet nearly all of this infrastructure is owned by a tiny proportion of the population. And therefore the gains from that go to this small group. We need to completely rethink the sense of property ownership and increase the share of that wealth that is socially owned and therefore serves the common good. And this is the concept of a sort of social dividend. All citizens should be entitled to a share of the gains from that wealth, most of which is inherited, but most of which is now owned by a tiny proportion. And that we need to tackle. If we were able to tackle that over the next 15 years in Britain, but not just in Britain, but across the world, that could be absolutely transformative. Of course, there would be huge battles, political battles to try and do it. And of course, the top 1% would fight to keep the wealth that they've mostly extracted. Very little of that wealth has been created by them. They would fight against it. But if we're to create harmonious, balanced, fair, economically resilient societies, that's the road we have to go down.
Good luck with the revolution.
I wouldn't call it a revolution. I mean, it would be a revolution, but it would require democratic methods to deliver.
When do you think that you'll get some results from the Welsh UBI study?
It'll be at least 18 months. It's 18. I think it finishes middle of next year, and then they've got to do the analysis. I think in the Finnish trial, it was up to a year before we got significant results of how it worked.
I mean, everybody's going to say it was great, aren't they? I mean, nobody's going to say I really didn't like getting that money and it made me unhappy.
Think trials, you don't decide. What it does is what trials do is they add to the evidential picture. They don't, because they're not, trials of how a scheme would actually work in practice. They're only partial, but they add to the body of evidence that contributes to the debate as to whether this is a good or bad thing. It will rule some things out, it will rule some things in. And you can't, I mean, no social scientist would take the results absolutely at face value. But what they also do, so they build an evidential base to help us decide whether this is a good thing or a bad thing. But they also raise the level of debate. The more people know about it, they hear about it, they get excited about it, they want to know about it. In a democratic societies, you can't introduce a reform of these sorts of scale unless there is a public debate first. And something like as big as this, you have to take the public with you. Just as if we were to try and raise more revenue from wealth or socialize a higher proportion of wealth, you'd have to have the public behind you. And that's why you need, the trials all help, the debate all helps. And I think that democratic input is essential if we're going to really make steps.
Thank you. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much, Kim. Thank you.
That was Stuart Lansley, who is author, among other things, of The Rich of the Poorer, How Britain Enriched the Few and Failed the Poor. Yes, he talked about raising a level of debate. Well, you can try. I mean, this listener, who remains anonymous, just texted to say, this guy's an idiot. What was your level of debate before you listened to Stuart Lansley, I wonder?